Over 200 years ago, George Washington wrote a letter to a friend saying this: "I have always considered marriage as the most interesting event in one's life, the foundation of happiness or misery." I thought that was a rather interesting way to phrase things, and it seems that in some ways things haven't changed a whole lot in the last couple hundred years, that there's still quite a challenge for some people, and this blending of two different personalities, two different unique experiences, two different viewpoints on things, trying to blend them into the same vision for the future within one family unit, sometimes is a challenge for people. After Winter Family Weekend theme of this year and this week's monthly member letter, both focused on unity, it got me to thinking about marriage. Got me to thinking about the fact that God is looking for unity in marriage as one of the physical areas that he talks about as having unity. The last sermon I gave here, I read some things from Genesis 1 and 2. I'd like to go back to Genesis 2 to begin the message today. As we know from those two chapters, after God created Adam, he warned him, told him not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then made an assessment about Adam being there by himself. This is in Genesis 2 and verse 18. It says, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." Now, I know a lot can be inferred from that statement, depending on your view of men. It can be, see, they're brain damaged. You know, they need somebody else. They're incomplete. Or it can be taken a little bit more like, well, you know, he's lonely. He needs a companion. So, again, it depends probably on your view of males. Over the years, I've come to the conclusion that that's really applicable to both sexes, men and women. We do like companionship. Some people like more companionship than others. Some are more open and talkative. Others are less talkative, maybe a little more reserved and quiet. But they still like companionship. And I've also realized and come to the conclusion that there are a lot of things that males typically bring to a relationship. And there are other things, different strengths and benefits that females would bring to a relationship. And the way that I've kind of reasoned this in my mind is that we'll both have certain attributes of God that can work together. If they work together harmoniously, they can work together well to build a good, solid family. And studies of brain science tend to back that up to a certain degree. Clearly, that doesn't mean everyone has to be married to be a Christian. You can be a good Christian and not be married. Paul obviously was used by God to write most of the New Testament as a single man. So it's not that we're deficient in that sense in terms of being a Christian. On the other hand, just being married doesn't mean we're automatically going to be one in that marriage. It's not an automatic thing. And it doesn't automatically complete us in that sense either. Now, we know what God's solution for Adam was. He made a companion, Eve. If we skip down to verse 20, it says, "So Adam gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the air, to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper comparable to him. And the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of the ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. And then the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man." Now, Adam named God's creation for the opposite sex and called her woman in general. The margin says, ish is the word for man. Isha is the Hebrew word for male or for female. And then in verse 24, it takes up the instruction again from God, describing the creation of both sexes. It says, "Therefore," in my Bible, actually, verse 23 is offset as a quotation from Adam. And then verse 24, it goes back to the dialogue. "Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife." The margin says to cling. And sometimes we've used the word leave, or we'll use the word cleave, leave and cleave. And it says, they shall become one flesh. So both are to leave their family of origin. They're to come together. They're to leave, and then they're to cleave to one another. And it says they're to become one flesh. So what's involved in all of this? I'd like to explore this topic a little bit today. What does it mean to leave, to cleave, and to become one? Is there any support for my assertion that this is God's instruction in verse 24, that it's God speaking, not Adam? Of course, much of society today doesn't believe that marriage between a man and a woman is God's instruction. They believe it's the construct of human beings, or a construct of human beings. And what can we do to build on this instruction to become one? Are there ways that we can strengthen a marriage to become more at one? Obviously, we start thinking in other areas. What about if you're not married? What if you want to be married? You need to think of some things ahead of time. We could get really broad with it. I'd get way too far if I get into too many of those details. But I'd like to at least discuss a few of these points. First, we'll notice in verse 24 that I think it's good to point out that this is instruction from God. This is not just something that Adam was saying, but it's actually God's instructions. We can find proof of that in the Gospels. You might remember, turning to Matthew 19, you might remember that Jesus was asked about the grounds for divorcing one's wife. Could that be done for just any reason? And historical references tell us that was a common issue of the day. That was a question that was asked. Can you divorce for just any reason? Or are there only very specific things that would allow for a divorce? In Matthew chapter 19, we see the Pharisees came testing him. Verse 3 tells us that. The Pharisees also came to him testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? This is the New King James translation. Just any reason. I mean, on a whim can you divorce your wife? So this was a question that was a big debate, apparently, in the Jewish society at that time. Some taught that divorce should be rare, only done as a last resort. And others said, well, yeah, you can take a more liberal view of that and divorce for almost any reason, whatever you want. It's obvious from the wording of this question. And notice Jesus' answer in verse 4, and he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. And verse 6 goes on to say, so then they who are no longer two but one flesh, therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. So Jesus, who was there when God created, or when he created Adam and Eve, said, the Creator said these words. That these are the words of God himself. These are not the words of Adam. These are the words of God. And why? Why were they to become one? Well, because Eve was taken from Adam's side, from her rib. That's a very close, intimate relationship that's being implied, that's being indicated here. A uniting connection between two human beings, a male and a female. They were the very same flesh and bone. God had used the bone and the flesh from Adam to build or to construct Eve from. Some of the very material Adam was composed of. God didn't get more dirt. He took something from Adam to make Eve. So it's a very close relationship. That fact alone should make it clear that there's no superiority, male or female. It's just we're all, in that sense, cut from the same cloth as human beings in the image of God. And notice that verse 6 here repeats this concept of unity. So then there are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not men separate. And clearly this oneness goes beyond a sexual union because don't separate what God has joined together. This is talking in a much broader sense, that God has joined them as one. Other humans were not to separate the two that God had joined in marriage. I was thinking about this aspect of God joining, and I was reading some notes from a sermon a number of years back that I had from Mr. Cecil Moranville. It was interesting. He quoted from a psychologist who stated that there are three main aspects to the marriage contract. And she was looking at marriage as a contract. And she said, well, there's common economic interest, there's the sharing of intimacy, and the raising of children. So she saw those as kind of the three main parts of a marriage contract that people would enter into. But notice God's perspective is a little different than a contract. And this was, I think, the point of Mr. Moranville's sermon. Proverbs chapter 2, if you'll turn there with me. Proverbs chapter 2, starting in verse 16. And I'm kind of breaking into the thought, but the proverb is talking about saving someone from turning them away from doing evil, turning them to paths of righteousness instead of the wrong direction. So we're breaking into this, but in verse 16, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house leads down to death and her paths to the dead. So God calls here in Proverbs 2, he calls the arrangement she made with the companion of her youth a covenant. In fact, calls it God's covenant, a covenant with God. So marriage is a divine covenant that we enter into with God being a part of the equation, being a part of what is taking place. Forsaking that covenant is described as a dead-end path. It doesn't lead to any good. It leads to the wrong direction. And this is obviously a very general warning about just taking it cavalierly and forgetting that covenant. You know, over the years, I've had access to our Church of God wedding ceremony wording, and we very consistently use the word covenant when we talk about marriage, when we talk about somebody getting married in the church. We use this word covenant. One question that each person we start with for each person is, so do you faithfully promise and covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses to take, mention the partner, to be your lawful wedded husband or wife? And so we use that phrase, we use that term, that we recognize we're entering into a covenant with God. And it's not to be taken lightly. And I realize there are some times when that covenant does get broken. There are some times when in the New Testament we understand there is a reason for separation or for divorce. I don't want to get bogged down on this point too much, but we don't use that word covenant very often. I found it interesting to look at Nelson's Bible Dictionary for some information about covenant. Here's a quote from Nelson's. It says, a covenant in the biblical sense implies much more than a contract or simple agreement. A contract has an end date, while a covenant is a permanent arrangement. Another difference is that a contract generally involves only one part of a person, such as a skill, while a covenant covers a person's total being. I thought that was kind of interesting. No end date, it's a perpetual thing, and it involves a whole person. Excuse me. It involves a whole person, not just a particular skill. Not entering into a covenant to have you build a house, have you cut a piece of wood, wasn't that in the sermonette, specific size and shape. This is a whole person that's entered into, or that's in this contract. And we see at the end of the Old Testament God's displeasure with Israel in Malachi 2 with their going back on their contract in their marriage covenants, Malachi 2. And verse 14, we'll just read this one verse. It says in Malachi 2 and verse 14, yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. She's your wife by covenant. The English Standard Version, which is pretty similar to the King James and New King James, just a little more modern English, says it this way. to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. So the focus there is on a lack of faithfulness. It's breaking that covenant and not being faithful to it. Some years back, I became aware of the National Marriage Project. They, in conjunction with the University of Virginia, produce a report every year called The State of Our Unions, and the focus is on marriage or on unions within the United States. As recently as a few years ago, the report decried the striking exodus away from marriage, especially those who are young people who have been maybe high school educated but not college educated. They were kind of calling this, in a sense, kind of middle America, that many of them were moving away from marriage. As recently as the 1980s, they said only 13% of children of that group, they're calling them moderately educated, were born out of wedlock. But by the late 2000s, it had jumped to 44%. It's just a striking increase. Here's a quote from that report from a couple of years ago. It says, researchers are finding that the disappearance of marriage in middle America is tracking with the disappearance of the middle class in the same communities, a change that strikes at the heart of the American dream. Now, what I found interesting was looking up this year's report, which would be the one for 2019. The title of this one was iFidelity. I thought, what's iFidelity? Well, obviously it has to do with internet, has to do with technology. The actual full title is iFidelity, Interactive Technology and Relationship Faithfulness. Every year they give an executive summary and then they get into the whole big long report, and I don't want to share a whole lot of this with you, but a little bit out of the executive summary. Sorry, getting a little tickle in my throat here. A little bit out of the executive summary makes it very clear that there's a worry about technology and infidelity over technology. Here are a couple of quick points. One says, although a clear majority of Americans in all generations express support for sexual fidelity in their relationships and report that they're sexually faithful in real life, today's young adults are markedly more likely to cross online boundaries related to sex and romance. For example, 18% of millennials are participants engaged in sexual talk online with someone besides their partner, compared to 3% of the greater silent generation participants, 6% of baby boomers, and 16% of Gen Xers. So the younger the people are, the more likely they are to engage in something like that. A second point they made in the executive summary said many online behaviors are rated by Americans, 70% or more, as unfaithful or cheating, including having a secret emotional relationship or sexting with someone other than a partner or spouse without the partner or spouse's knowledge and consent. You know, what's sometimes a little discouraging to me in working with youth in the church is that periodically I hear about youth in the church who get involved in some of these things with technology. It's really sad to hear that. They get caught up in sexting or in pornography or other kinds of online infidelity. Now, they're not married yet, but they are being unfaithful to their eventual spouse, whoever they will eventually marry, if they're able to get married. It's very clear, God expects oneness, unity, and faithfulness within marriage. That's what he's decrying the Jews at the end of the book of Malachi about, that they were not being faithful to one another, both physically and emotionally. And there is psychological damage that's done when someone is unfaithful emotionally. And it's very hard, once that trust is broken, it's very hard to rebuild that trust. And in some cases, it can't be rebuilt, which is very sad. But God expects fidelity, and that's what helps strengthen and build that unity and build and maintain that unity within a marriage relationship. Now, going to another aspect, if we go back to Genesis chapter 1, very obviously God intended families to grow. certainly from the very beginning, when there were only two people on the earth, there needed to be more. God is looking for many children. If we go back to Genesis 1, Genesis 1, verse 27 and 28, God expected children within that marriage relationship or within that family. Verse 27, Genesis 1, 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. And then he goes on to talk about having dominion over the fish of the sea and birds and every living thing on the earth. And God told Noah the same thing. Noah and his family, the same thing after the flood. You know, be fruitful, multiply. He told Abraham that he would bless him, that he would bless his descendants, that he would have so many descendants it would be like the stars of the sky or the sand of the seashore if you could count them. So he was talking about great blessings by descendants. Now, we have also consistently recognized and taught in the church that in today's world, a couple really ought to plan in terms of family, plan in terms of children, to make sure that you're able to provide physically and emotionally for those children. That's another area where husbands and wives need to be on the same page, that they need to be unified. Yeah, they need to be in agreement on how many children, when they're going to have them. Those types of things are very important. Those are personal decisions, but ones, again, on which there should be unity. And it's a part of being one flesh, being one, being at one, like God and Jesus Christ are. And a married couple also needs to be at one in terms of how they're going to train those children. If we go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, we know God does give instruction about training children, bringing them up in the instruction of God's way of life. Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Now in Hebrew, and in Jewish groups, they call this the Shema. It starts with the word hear. The Hebrew word Shema means listen or hear. And so they just refer to that. This is a common prayer among Jews. But I think the margin has a very good way of explaining how this is best understood. My margin says, for the Lord our God, the Lord is one, says the Lord our God, the Lord alone. Or the Lord is the only one. He's the only God we worship. We don't have a panorama of gods. There's a God of the sea, a God of the air, a God of rain, a God of storms, a God of lightning, a God of... We don't have all that stuff. We don't have polygamy. What would that be? Polytheism. We don't have all kinds of different gods. Polygamy. We don't have that either. Where'd that come from? But don't have all these different gods. There's one. We worship the one God. This is what the emphasis is. But going on with the statement in verse 6, these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. Now, training our children is something God expects us to do as a married couple. If we have children, he expects that we train them in God's way, that we train them about God's truth. It's what's expected of godly parents. And they need to be on the same page of being able to do that. We came across an article recently on a website that encourages parents to train their children to obey. Thought, well, that's kind of interesting. You don't see a whole lot of articles just on different websites about that these days. But they said, we really need to train our children to do that. I mean, that's what God expects of us. He's our parent. He expects us to obey. We ought to teach our children to obey. I know some of you probably remember the Growing Kids God's Way classes that the Ezos taught, the first time obedience, to respond and to obey. It's great training for our relationship with God. God expects us as his children to obey him, and we do our children a huge disservice if we don't help them learn to do that early in life. And of course, there are all kinds of areas in which to train our children. manners, how to show respect to older people, how to talk with adults, how to interact with adults, teach children to be responsible, to take responsibility for their own mistakes, to learn self-discipline, to learn to be self-correcting, to teach them the value of work, teach them about the proper use of money, about giving, about serving, about helping. There's so many things to teach our children. And again, as a husband and wife, as a couple, we need to be on the same page. We need to be in agreement. We need to be in unity on those things. Because if we're not, and we're showing and teaching two different things, we're confusing our children. They don't know what to believe. They don't know what to follow. There's so many, many things about life and about social graces. We need to be unified in those areas when we have children. And as we get a little bit older, we're past the age of doing that with our children. I mean, they're grown and out on their own, and now we've got grandchildren. So are we going to teach the same things to them? Thankfully, their parents are teaching them. I think they're doing a good job with our grandchildren. But as grandparents, I feel we also have that responsibility to support that teaching of the parents, to be on the same page with our children, to be, in that sense, united at one, having unity of purpose and goal for our grandchildren, as they do for their children. So, again, being at one, having that unity within the marriage relationship is a very important thing where it comes to children. What other areas? How else can we become, or what do we do to become one with a spouse? What does unity mean anyway? I mean, when it comes to a marriage. I know Mr. Franks kind of explored that at Winter Family Weekend. What is it like? What does unity look like in the church? What does it look like in a marriage? Does it mean everybody, both parties, like or dislike the same things? Well, no, obviously it doesn't. We're all individuals. We all have different likes and dislikes. Kathy likes scrapbooking, card making, other creative things. You don't want to see me making scrapbooks. you don't want to look at cards that I would try to make. That's just not something I'm good at, not something I have an interest in. I like hunting. I like working with wood. I like working on mechanical things. I like other things, technology. She tells me I can't ever leave her because she won't know how to work certain things in technology. So I tell her, you can never leave me because I wouldn't know how to do lots of other stuff. Well, I would know, but it wouldn't be done nearly as well. She likes food. She likes learning to cook good, healthy foods. I like to eat it. It's a great relationship. See, we're at one. We're at peace, and we're very different, aren't we? So it doesn't mean that we're exactly the same, that we all have exactly the same interests, or we're exactly the same in every way. She likes flowers and pretty things in the yard. I like growing tomatoes and peppers and vegetables in the garden, beans and sugar snap peas and that type of thing. And she likes to cook them, and again, I like to eat them. We just see how well this works. It's just great, great relationship. But you know, there is one thing, one aspect here that I wanted to talk about in terms of building unity is good communication. Good communication is absolutely essential in a marriage if you want to build unity. We have in our Life, Hope, and Truth website, there's a whole section, I call them silos, but there's one whole silo that's related or that's focused on relationships. And there are a lot of articles in there about marriage, a lot of articles that deal with relationships as a whole, but a lot of articles about marriage. One of them was written by Mr. Greg Sargent. The title is Four Lethal Marriage Problems. Now, he quotes in that from a book that John Gottman wrote, The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work, a book that I've read many times and have actually used in trying to help people learn about relationships in marriage and building good relationships within marriage. He identifies in that four enemies of marriage, and they're listed as criticism, contempt, defense, and stonewalling. Now, I would encourage you to read the article because I don't have time to go through all of those, but I will give you just a very brief description of each of those. Criticism, For example, criticism involves censure, disparagement, condemnation, denigration, that kind of thing. I mean, we all make mistakes. I printed out this little meme. Thought this was an interesting one. It says, there are no perfect husbands and no perfect wives, but if you'll keep believing in each other, there will be plenty of perfect moments in your marriage. That's kind of a nice way to put it. No perfect husbands, no perfect wives. So what do we do when we don't communicate well or when we do something that's not good in a relationship? Well, it's usually fixed by apologizing, isn't it? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to do that. And we look to change. We look to not repeat that. But the issue with criticism is when criticism is just a constant attitude of criticism, criticize, 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 that's a whole different story. And that's a serious, serious problem in a marriage. It's one of the major enemies of a good marriage relationship. The second one, contempt. Contempt indicates a total lack of any admiration. It's a total lack of any appreciation for the other person. And it's often accompanied by things like disgust, scorn, disdain, and mocking. Again, obviously, that's very, very toxic to a relationship, very toxic to unity within a marriage. Defense, the third one, that's kind of a natural human reaction to any kind of criticism. Anytime any of us are criticized, we tend to get a little defensive. Well, that wasn't what I meant, or that my motives were pure, or I didn't have that motive in mind. And that's not necessarily bad. We may want to defend our actions or our words. But here's the deal. If we are constantly defensive and we're never willing to look at, maybe I'm not quite as pure in that word or action as I think. Maybe I need to take another look at this. If we never take that perspective, we are going to get nothing but a wall of defense to our partner. That destroys that level of trust that I trust that you will listen when I talk about something that bothers me, and that when you talk about something that bothers you, you know I will listen. And I'll try to see if there's something I can do. So are we really being truthful, or are we just simply trying to sidestep responsibility for what we said or did? Again, if we're always defensive and refuse to ever take responsibility, that's a huge barrier to being at one. It's a huge barrier to unity. Now, stonewalling, the fourth one, that one's a little bit more involved. In fact, it can take many, many, many different subtle forms, delaying, halting a conversation, repeating inconsequential material, throwing dust in the air, basically. Well, this doesn't really matter to the question, but or whatever the issue is, but I'm just going to keep repeating it over and over and over again. Hope I can get you off track and get you to forget what you're talking about in the first place. I mean, there are all kinds of ways of refusing to acknowledge the issue, which is what stonewalling boils down to. Simply refusing to budge on your stance. They're all examples of stonewalling. I thought it was interesting. Mr. Sargent wrote in his article that politicians seem to be masters at that. Never really get around to addressing the exact issue. They just keep their talking points. If you've listened to the news ever, that's what we hear, isn't it? Their talking points over and over and over and over and over and over again, and the person's trying to ask another question, and they never get to that question. They just keep stonewalling and giving their talking points. Obviously, that kind of person cannot be engaged in a respectful conversation. You don't really have good communication. Therefore, you can't work together. If you're doing that in your marriage, it won't build unity. It won't build oneness. Again, I would encourage you to read the whole article, but if you noticed, every one of those involves communication, doesn't it? It involves how we share information with one another. We listening, are we listening, are we talking with one another? Jesus had something to say about this in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. He gives some ground rules for communication. In Matthew chapter 5, in verse 37, the Sermon on the Mount starts in chapter 4. I'm sorry, the beginning of chapter 5. And here toward the end of chapter 5, we find in verse 37, "But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." The bottom line of this, what is he saying? Be truthful. Be truthful. Be honest. If you mean yes, say yes. If you say yes, mean yes. If you mean no, or if you say no, mean no. Don't try to be both. It's one of the fundamental ground rules for good communication. You have to be honest. You have to be open with anyone, but especially with a spouse. And when you tell your spouse yes about something, make sure you follow through. Make sure you do what you say you're going to do. That builds confidence. That builds trust. It builds the relationship. It builds unity. It builds confidence in the relationship. Now, we also find the Apostle Paul making a comment in Colossians chapter 4 about communication. That to be is another huge ground rule for communication. And I'm talking mainly in marriage between husband and wife, but it really relates to communication with anybody. Our interaction with any other person ought to be focused on this as well. Another huge rule about communication, Colossians 4 and verse 6, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." Again, the English Standard Version says it this way. It says, "Let your speech always be gracious." Let your speech be gracious. Not sometimes, not just when you want something from someone else, but always. Let your speech always be gracious. The Good News Bible says your speech should always be pleasant and interesting. Pleasant and interesting. Again, here's another vital ground rule for good communication. I mentioned John Gottman a while ago in his book. One of the things he writes in his introduction is that when he meets with people who are having marriage difficulties, he can usually tell within 5, 10, 15 minutes whether there's a good chance that couple is going to work it out, or whether there's a good chance that they have solidified their positions and there is no bringing them together again. How does he do that? Well, he said it's how they talk to one another. Do they talk to one another with the kind of kindness that you talk to someone with when you're interested in dating them? You know, you're very nice, you're very kind, best foot forward. Does that continue in the marriage and actually grow in the marriage? Or does that somehow get tossed out the window and all of a sudden you're gruff and you're short and you're not speaking graciously, you're not listening? Are you short, dismissive, contemptuous? If so, you're headed for trouble. Because it's the solidification of positions and not being willing to make changes in that that comes through in the communication. So that was one of the things that he says. They're no longer speaking to and about one another with tenderness, with compassion. So again, we can give you maybe a little before marriage tip. How does the other person talk about people they're familiar with? They may talk nicely to you. How do they talk to their parents? How do they talk to their siblings? How do they talk to other people that they've been around for a long time? Chances are they will eventually talk to you that very same way. Look at how they deal with other people, with other family members. Are they gracious, kind, or dismissive and contemptuous? All right, I need to keep moving here. Let me give you another very important area to be at one or to be unified in. Numerous sources, when you do a search for problems in marriage, reasons for marriage failures, reason for marriage problems. You could find any kind of number, any list, numbers of lists. I found one had 80 problems in marriage. Wow, I am not going to read through a list of 80 issues that could possibly be problems in relationships. But there were a lot of more concise lists. Dr. James Dobson has a list that he calls 11 marriage killers you need to avoid. And I thought, well, he's a pretty solid, Christian perspective writer. He wrote this blog a couple of years ago. But a number of sources will list money and finances as either the number one or the number two issue for or reason for issues within relationships. James Dobson, in his article, lists the first one as overcommitment and physical exhaustion. I thought, well, that's an interesting one to list as number one. I have told many, many people, everyone I talk to is running at about 150%. Because people come up to me, wow, you're busy, you're doing so many things. Everybody I know is busy and wearing a bunch of hats. Everybody I talk to, well, except for Mr. John Trotter. He's retired now. So he told me last night, oh, I can do a sermon in Ruston tomorrow. Oh, I can just make another one for the next week. I'm retired now. That will change, I'm sure, Mr. Trotter. But anyway, everybody just seems to be stressed to the max with so much to do. So I think, well, that's a pretty good reason or pretty good thing to put as a number one marriage killer if you let it do that, overcommitment and physical exhaustion. But his number two was excessive credit and conflict over how money will be spent. It's a very common thing that people don't get on the same page. Either they weren't there to begin with or they drift apart in their view of finances and use of finances. It's sometimes hard to get back on the same page. When I counsel people for marriage, pre-marriage counseling, I always talk about finances. I talk about communication. I talk about the sexual relationship because that can be a big issue. And I talk about money. Talk about finances. I ask things like, will you view your income as joint, or is it going to be mine and yours? That's yours, this is mine. Or is it going to be ours? I think that says, in my mind, it says a world about the people's position within that relationship. Are we one? Do we have one pool? Now, you may set it up any number of ways. I know some families say, okay, we're going to have two different, this much is going to go for food, and you handle that, and this much is for other things, I'll handle that. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways you can look at it, but do you view it as we have one pool of income that is ours together? Will you make sure that both of you are aware of, again, talking of pre-marriage counseling, that you're aware of any debts you have? Your potential partner needs to know that. They have the right to know that. Any financial commitments that you might have? Any expenses that you have coming up? If you discussed and talked about a budget, I know that's a four-letter word in some people's vocabulary, don't like budget, feel like it restricts them. I've got a different perspective on that, but as Dave Ramsey does, that a budget frees you to spend that money. When you know it's in the budget, you're free to spend it. Tells you you're free to spend this amount. Now, you can't spend more, but you're free to spend that amount. Have you talked about a budget? Are you planning to have one? Have you talked about the importance of life insurance? Have you talked about the importance of other kinds of insurance in your life? I remember a couple, a very, very sad story, a couple that got married at Ambassador while they were still students. And that summer, he took a job and ended up dying in a terrible accident, had no life insurance, so now there's a new widow and she has no life insurance and she has obligations that he had obligated her to in taking the job that he got. A very, very, very sad thing to see. So I talk about the importance of that, and most importantly, I ask couples whether they're financially able to get married. Proverbs 24. Usually turn to Proverbs 24 and read this one. Are you financially stable enough to get married, or would it be better if you maybe waited a few months or 6 months or a year till you got yourself on a better financial footing to get married? Proverbs chapter 24, verse 27 says, prepare your outside work, make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterward build your house. The phrase build your house, many commentaries point out, this has to do with establishing a household, establishing a family. Setting a family up. It's equivalent of founding a family, according to Albert Barnes' commentary. In other words, it's a warning against being too hasty in getting married when you're not really financially prepared for it, that you'd really be better off to wait a little bit till you've got a little bit more financial footing. So that's an important aspect where people need to communicate as well. It's an important area for being on the same page. You know, as I think about wrapping this up, let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. I think about marriage. I think about some of the things that God says about marriage, the importance of being one in marriage. In Ephesians chapter 5, we find a good bit of instruction from the Apostle Paul about husbands, about wives. The whole books have been written about the two things that are mentioned, submitting and loving, showing love. Verse 22, when Paul, Ephesians 5 and verse 22, Paul says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. There's a submission aspect in a marriage, in a godly marriage. And in verse 25, he talks to husbands and said, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. So people don't typically submit to someone they don't respect. So there's a respect factor that needs to be there. And the love factor is husbands need to learn to love their wives. They need to learn how to show love to their wife. They need to know what language their wife is speaking. What is her love language? How do you show her that you love her? You may be saying it in your language, but if she doesn't understand that language, there's no communication going on. We learned early on that in our marriage that I didn't need to bring gifts. I would want to bring home flowers. You know, I'd want to work. And she loves flowers. But very early on, she said, you know, gifts are nice. It's okay. I'll turn my nose up at them, but I don't need them. I came to realize what she really enjoys or acts of service. Take the trash out. You know, unload the dishwasher. What? Me? In the kitchen? I unload the dishwasher. Whenever I realize it needs to be unloaded, and I'm there and she's not, unload the dishwasher. Little acts of service. Those things mean a lot if that's their love language. But if you're not talking their language, you may be saying, I love you, but all she's hearing is, wah, 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 right? Not talking my language. So, submission, that respect factor, loving your wife, showing your wife that you love her by your actions and your words. Now, what's interesting is we get down through the end of this. He talks quite a bit about husbands loving their wives as their own bodies, verse 28. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Here's the interesting thing. He now shifts to talking about a spiritual relationship. It's a physical relationship, but he says it needs to be done in the way that God loves the church, that the Lord, Jesus Christ, loves the church. Verse 30, for we are members of his body, and of his flesh and of his bones. So the church, he's saying, is just like Adam. We're really cut from that cloth as members of the church. We're a part of that body that is the body of Christ. Just like in a marriage relationship, from the very beginning, God said, Adam and Eve, you're a part of Adam. You came from him. You're cut from the same flesh and bone that he was composed of. And now he turns this into saying, this is the way it is in the church. Verse 31, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. See that she respects her husband. Husbands, see that you love your wives and that you show that love. That's the way you build unity within the marriage. That's the way you build unity within that household. So there's much more, a lot more we could say about marriage. If you're married, I hope you've found something in these instructions from God's Word that will help you build the unity within your marriage. If you're divorced or separated, or you're a widower or a widower, a widow, hopefully you can use some of these points in just your relationships with one another. You know, if you're hoping to get married, I hope you found something here also that would be of use as a guide. What do I look for when I'm looking for a mate? What do I look for in someone? And again, if you're alone after having been married, hopefully you find some guidance on building some unity with other people, regardless of our physical status. It's important to realize God wants us all to strive for unity with one another, within the church, and certainly within our individual marriages, within our families. When it comes to marriage, as Jesus stated, God who made humans said it's because we're the same flesh and blood that a man should leave his father and mother, should cleave to his wife, and the two should become one. Be unified, be united. It takes effort, but in a good marriage, it's well worth the effort.